Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, which believes great beer can be as exciting as great music. Since 1988, Goose Island has been committed to that belief by brewing new styles of beer like 312 Urban Wheat Ale, Sophie Farmhouse Ale, and Bourbon County Stout. Goose Island, to what's next? GooseIsland.com.
This is Sound Opinions, Greg, and we're going to be talking about summer songs. This is the second time we've done this. We originally did it back in 2006, right? So when we do these list kind of shows, we try not to ever repeat ourselves, and we try to not be too obvious. I don't have any Brian Eno on there, okay? And then we also go through our archives and see what else have we played. You know, like Lazing on a Sunny Afternoon by the Kinks? We played it in another show for another purpose. So I had a bit of a challenge, but I really think I came up with some good picks, and I'm eager to hear yours. That's later in the show, but first we're going to talk to Jessica Hopper.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot, and he's Jim DeRogatis. And today we're in the studio with music writer Jessica Hopper. Jessica is a senior editor at Pitchfork, and she's just published her book, The First Collection of Criticism by a Living Female Rock Critic.
This is a career-spanning anthology of articles that Jessica wrote over the years, from her start as a punk fanzine writer to her pieces about pop culture icons and sometimes pariahs like Lana Del Rey and Miley Cyrus, and that widely read Village Voice piece where she interviewed me about the R. Kelly controversy. That received over 7 million hits on the web. Jessica, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Greg.
I think we ought to start right off the bat. One of our peers in Chicago, rock critic we've admired a long time. Let's start with the title, though, because I love the history of rock criticism. And I know what you're talking about when you titled your book, The First Collection, by a Living Female Rock Critic, but I think most listeners won't.
The amount of books by female rock critics that are just of criticism are almost non-existent. Part of the reason that I titled it this, other than it was sort of the joke title that people demanded become the real title, was that you have to set a precedent in some ways for other books to be allowed to come after it. When I wanted to do this book, I was told by publishers, I was told by agents, I was told by different people. Chuck Klosterman and Rob Sheffield are basically the only people allowed to put out collections of criticism. They are the exceptions to the rule because essays don't sell, music criticism doesn't sell, no woman has done this, who's a lot, you know, basically that there was a gendered precedent here that needed to be set.
Well, one of the first essays I think that got you noticed nationwide, Emo Where the Girls Aren't, is in the book. And it seems to speak to some of what you're talking about in the title here. You weren't seeing a reflection of your concerns as a music listener, as a female music listener. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but is that true? Do you feel there's a different perspective that women bring to music criticism that you weren't hearing from the male end of the spectrum?
Well, I definitely feel like that. I think that the experience of even being a woman at a show is different. You know, you're participating. Participation in music is sometimes different than your male peers. And even how you receive lyrics or music or a band's image can be really different. So I do think having something that speaks directly to the experience, whether it's criticism or music, seeing your own experience of life reflected back to you in lyrics is really crucial.
What got you into it in the first place? Writing is not exactly the easiest way to make a living. What was the light bulb moment for you as a young writer?
Well, I kind of fell into all of this almost by accident. It happened because someone told me no, essentially. Growing up in Minneapolis, I was reading a lot of the local press about one of my favorite bands, Babes in Toyland, and I was in all of ninth grade, and I just thought, all of these people are getting it wrong. I called around and said, your article about Babes in Toyland was wrong. I need to write it from my perspective. And people would say, well, have you ever written before? I said, no. And they're like, how old are you? And I say, 15. It was like, all but hung up on me. And I just thought, I'll show all of them. And I started a fanzine. And then within 2 issues of that, I was writing for City Pages. Within 2 years of that, I was writing for Spin. That's how my career started, was people saying, sorry, your fangirlism doesn't qualify as expertise. 38 now, and I've been getting published bylines since 10th grade, so.
Yeah. Well, we should explain to people, Greg and I also came from the fanzine world. Mm-hmm. In the fanzine world, throughout the 80s, into the 90s, if no one was going to publish you, you did it yourself. You went to the basement, you typed it out, you pasted it up, you went to Kinko's in the middle of the night when your friend was working, ran off 400 copies on their key card. Now, Jessica, it's so much easier. People start a blog. Mm-hmm. It's for free on WordPress, right? Mm-hmm. you have a huge influence on other young women who are following in your footsteps and doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. Does that feel good? Are you seeing writers come up behind you now?
I really hope so. I mean, I feel like it is a very different world now if you are a young woman with an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now that I'm an editor at Pitchfork, I get to help bring up a lot of these voices. And I pay a lot of attention to Twitter, to blogs, to Tumblr, and looking for young women who have a voice and have a very distinct and strong opinion about the music that they listen to and the culture that they pay attention to.
One of the things that's jumped out to me as well is the idea that music, the process of making music, is inspiring to somebody who's trying to figure out how to be a writer. And for you, it seemed like Kathleen Hanna was a big influence in that regard. Seeing her at a young age, impressionable age,
mm-hmm.
gave you the license to say, why can't I express myself
Absolutely.
The way she's doing?
Riot Girl basically gave a name to what I was feeling. I liked some music, but I didn't see myself in it. I didn't hear my own experience being reflected. But seeing someone who was up there so defiant and empowered really transformed where I saw that I could be in punk rock and the way that it gave me license because I wanted to speak to other women the way that she was speaking to me and kind of take that space at the table regardless of whether anyone was giving me permission.
How do you feel about the word post-feminism? There was this big notion in the late alternative era about, you know, we are now post-feminist. That fight's been fought.
Feminism is fortunately changing and becoming more inclusive of different perspectives and intersectional, as we say. But that it definitely does feel like a different world these days in terms of how often we hear a feminist or even radical feminist perspective about music, you mm-hmm. know, because when I was coming up, these were relegated to fanzines or, you know, a handful of blogs. And today, you know, there's popular critics who use a feminist lens to approach music. And I think it's still very much a necessary framework.
You know, the $1 million question that I always wrestle with is how we can separate the art from the artist. Now, I should note that I'm included here in the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic in the sense that you did a long interview with me about R. Kelly and my work on R. Kelly. It wound up in the Village Voice, got like 7.5 million hits. Obviously, you tapped into something that I had been working on for 10 years, and us talking about it together made an impact. Kelly was accused of preying on many young, underage women. There is no answer, mm-hmm. but I wonder how you feel about that. If you know a band has objectionable lyrics that are misogynistic, if you know in their personal lives that they're behaving misogynistically, how do you deal with that as a critic and a fan?
It's really difficult, and this is something that I talk about a lot with my friends. I talk about it a lot with other writers and other editors. And, you know, the thing is I'm not doing extensive background checks on every, you know, band I pull up on Bandcamp to make sure they're ethically clean.
You don't sign up to be the moral police when you become a rock critic.
And yeah. I'm not interested in that. I really have to just mind my own heart, what feels okay for me to listen to. I'm never going to go to an R. Kelly show. And I think it's up to each of us. I can't separate art from the artist. Music means too much to me to say I'm just going to listen to it purely for pleasure.
Yeah, it's mere entertainment.
Because it's never been that for me.
Well, I think what was interesting about your article about Jim is that you're upfront about this at the start. You did basically a 180. You came from the perspective of, I'm an R. Kelly fan, and you came to it, to Jim's article, having some kind of a moment where you reconsidered that. Was it Jim's writing that made you reconsider? Why did you reconsider?
Well, it was sort of a funny thing that happened where, you know, I had pretty much stopped listening to R. Kelly not too long after the initial charges. I was at Pitchfork when he was headlining, and I had meant to leave, and instead I sort of stayed and was, like, enchanted by, you know, the show. And I think I was being fairly flip about it on Twitter, in part because people were challenging me and saying, you're a feminist, Jessica, you care about women, you care about women of color, why don't you care about this? And I had to take it to heart because the people who were calling me out were people that I respected, including Jim. Mm-hmm. And talking to Jim about the full scope of why it is that nobody wanted to have this conversation and these types of conversations about artists whose personal pasts or personal histories are difficult at best. We had such a deep conversation that touched the lives of a lot of people.
Yeah, it's nice to know that people care.
Yeah.
Not even they can stop me now. Will I be flying overhead? The heavy words can't bring me down. Boy, I've been raised from the dead.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and we're speaking with Jessica Hopper, author of the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic. Jessica, in your book, you come to the defense of both Lana Del Rey and Miley Cyrus. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're vilified a lot in the music press as no talents for killing pop music. What was it that made you want to jump into the fray about these two artists?
The myth of Lana Del Rey was just getting, you know, re-perpetuated in every piece and about how fake she was. And there was all these sort of different rumors swirling. And I just thought, what's the actual truth of this girl? Because we're going to buy whatever she's selling. But what is her real story? And it's always been really fascinating to me, you know, the different arguments about authenticity and fakeness and image, particularly in relationship to female artists. And with Miley, why she fascinates me is because I think she's giving us everything that we want as pop consumers in a really gross way. Miley Cyrus is basically a billboard for us to project all our thoughts and feelings and disgust on. I think I say it in the book, it will be about her knowingly filleting a sledgehammer,
right,
and what that means to us more than it will ever be about her singing or how she sings.
We've been talking with music and culture writer Jessica Hopper, author of the first collection of criticism by a living female rock critic. Thank you, Jessica, for being our guest on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Doesn't that make you want to jump in the pool or at least have a hot dog grill?
Very nostalgic right now.
DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Summertime. All right, doesn't matter. Song can come out the last day of December, can come out, you know, in the fall, it can come out in the spring. There are certain songs that just scream summer song, all right? The release date almost becomes irrelevant. It conjures a vibe of hot, sweaty days of hanging by the pool, of barbecues, of beer outside, of long nights under the stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
None of which I like. I prefer to be indoors in dark, dank rock clubs myself. But you are a maven of summer. You're going to start us off. Second time we're doing this show. Great summer songs. We got a new batch for you. What's your first pick?
Well, Jim, you have to go to California, right, if you want to write ultimate summer songs, or it seems that way anyway. Now,
well, we did California Sun last time.
And I'm glad I don't live in California, but I get the whole idea about that culture and what it inspired musically. So much great stuff over the years. Now, in the late 50s, early 60s, you know, the car culture songs were everywhere. Chuck Berry, the American Graffiti soundtrack, kind of looked at that era and the music that was being written and sung about car culture. The Beach Boys were part of that pack as well. But this song, you know, kind of separated them, as many of their songs did during that era. Little Honda, it's about a little motorbike, as Brian Wilson referred to it. Not just a motorcycle, but a little motorbike, a little smaller, a little more zippy on the road. And he wrote an homage to it in this song, Little Honda. Now, one of the things that's really cool about this song, or the original by the Beach Boys, was that he insisted that his brother, Carl, play this fuzz tone guitar riff on it. And Carl's going, what do you mean, man? That sounds awful.
Yeah.
Brian's like, no, trust me, this song needs this. And they put it out on an EP in 64. It later came out on one of their albums. It was a relatively successful song for them. But Leave It to Yolo Tango, this great New Jersey trio, who love to dig into rock archives and cover songs that they feel have not been celebrated enough, to find this particular gem and put it on their I Can Hear the Heart Beating as One album in 1997. So Yolo Tango's cover of Little Honda really does it justice, and especially to that fuzz-tone guitar that Carl Wilson plays, as played now by Ira Camplin, really cranking up the fuzz box. It is Little Honda, the Yolo Tango version of the Beach Boys' 1964 song on Sound Opinions. That is Yolo Tango with a cover of the Beach Boys' Little Honda on Sound Opinions, my first great song of the summer. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, Jim's first selection for our summer mixtape. And do you have a song you want to add to the collection? Give us a call at 888-859-1800.